The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This year marks the 101st anniversary of Mother's Day. Though signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson, it was an activist named Anna Jarvis who is credited as the true matriarch of Mother's Day. Andrew Phillips is the curator of the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library and Museum in Staunton, Virginia. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
What inspired Jarvis to lobby for the creation of Mother's Day?
Ironically enough, it was primarily her own mother. Anne Maria Reeves Jarvis was a leader in the suffrage movement and was particularly active during the Civil War. She started what were called Mother's Day work clubs, which gave help and care to wounded soldiers from both the Union and Confederate side. And she was active with Susan B. Anthony, Harriet Beecher Stowe, many of the names that are much more familiar to people.
So this daughter of a suffragette, Anna Jarvis, lobbies for the holiday. What did you think it should be about?
Well, in the early stages, it was a much more radical idea of the holiday beyond what we have today. It was seen very much as a way to encourage women of all types to think on their contributions and what they could achieve and where they could go. It became the more commercial holiday where it becomes a much more personal thing. Maybe that's a better way to say it. It became a more personal holiday where I'm honoring my own mother and my own grandmother, as opposed to mothers as a whole.
Mm-hmm. The collective mother, I guess.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So she made an appeal to the president, and Wilson signed the proclamation making the second Sunday of May Mother's Day. What happened next is a little surprising. Can you give us the narrative?
Well, it takes a little while to pick up, like any brand new holiday. It was originally came through Congress as one of those congressional joint resolutions, perhaps akin to the bills that go through renaming a post office. There's not usually a lot of opposition to those, I suppose. But as the holiday grew, particularly in the 1920s, it became the more personal holiday. Hallmark enters into the picture about that time when they start producing Mother's Day cards. And Jarvis was disappointed with the way the holiday developed, to the point that she at one point is arrested for disturbing the peace by protesting against it. Later in her life, she says that she wished she hadn't even bothered starting the holiday, seeing the way it went.
So the holiday that she petitioned for, she begins to petition to take it back.
Yes. She was less successful with that second petition, though.
Right. And interesting because, you know, we've come to call Mother's Day a Hallmark holiday, but it really was Hallmark kind of taking it on board to sell cards?
I suppose you could say that. Mm-hmm. Hallmark and many other companies, they were not alone.
Yeah, and I read actually online that the Florist Telegraph Delivery, which we now know as FTD, actually tried to win Jarvis over by offering her a commission on carnation sales. Do you know if that's true?
I've heard similar rumors. I don't think I've ever seen the source material for that. But the carnations, I mean, they were a big part of Mother's Day. When she originally started the holiday, prior to Congress getting involved, she handed out some 500 white carnations to the guests at the very first Mother's Day service, which was held at a church in West Virginia.
She had a pretty sad end as well. What can you tell us about the trajectory of Anna Jarvis?
Well, it's unfortunate, obviously. She was very much a part of the greater women's rights movement that led to the national right to vote and the amendment that gave that right. But and she, I believe she passed away in the mid-late 40s, but she was never as well known as some of her contemporaries, wasn't honored the way they were, and became known as the critic of Mother's Day. And it's difficult to become popular when you're railing against the holiday where you're telling your mother how much you love her.
30 million Mother's Day cards will be exchanged this May. What do you think Anna Jarvis would have to say about that?
I suppose it would depend on if she got a fuller view of how we deal with holidays today, compared to Christmas, maybe, or Halloween. Mother's Day is small potatoes in the commercialization department. But again, it really just ties back to she wasn't looking to a personal holiday as much as she was one of women's empowerment, I suppose you could say. It's important to understand, I suppose, the origins of these things. We could look at Christmas again. It's the German Christmas trees and everything that we now see is so instrumental. It was looked at by the Puritans as something to be banned and not celebrated at all. So we've come a long way with a lot of different holidays in this country.
Andrew Phillips, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Mama, you raised me right. Mama, showed me the light. Mama, through pain and strife. Mama, you gave us life.
When I fell down, you were there to pick me up. When I felt bad, you were there to build me up. Gave everything you had in the world to me, and you made me the man I'm supposed to be.
Jane, even though I don't say it often enough, I appreciate everything you did for us. Never take it for granted, cause it ain't hard to see. The best parts of you were now a part of me. Oh, Mama.
And when it was cold outside, you kept us warm and held us down.
Mom, get out!
Oh,
we're in the studio!
Just checking on my guy.
You're making a track, you idiot! Just leave!
Go!
Give my one true love, my heart, my mom.
If you'd like to embrace the ideals of Anna Jarvis this Mother's Day, we recommend thinking outside of the gift box and doing something unexpected and meaningful. Something as simple, perhaps, as sitting down for an intimate conversation. Our next story comes from StoryCorps and allows us to listen one-on-one to one of those intimate moments that can only be shared between a mother and a child. In this case, a very famous mother and a very famous child.
Hi, my name is Yoko Ono Lennon. My age is 77. Location is in New York City. And relationship to partner, I am his mom.
Hi, my name is Sean Lennon. Or Sean Ono Lennon, or Sean Taro Ono Lennon, Taro being my Japanese name, and I'm her son. So, I get to ask you the questions today, and I'm so often, and you're so often, asked about the Beatles and John Lennon, which is interesting, but I think it would be really nice if we could talk about your life. So, how is it that you were born?
I was born from my mother, who is a Yasuda, and my father, who is an Ono.
And you were essentially disowned from the Ono family, right, because of...
having a very kind of outlandish life.
Right, because they're such a posh conservative family.
Well, you know, my father was a banker, but he was an independent spirit. He was a very good pianist and very much into music.
And he taught you piano, or did you have a piano teacher?
I had a piano teacher because I was born when my father was already in San Francisco.
And your dad was banking here?
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, so you're saying you hadn't met him before?
Oh, yes.
And you remember meeting him? How old were you?
He was big. I was 2.5 years old. And the time that I met him, my mother and my father was kissing, and I was looking like this, you know, like, well, maybe he's going to kiss me, too.
And he hadn't seen Grandma in 2.5 years?
Yeah.
She must have been so lonely.
Well, probably. But, you know, the thing is, you see, my mother was a beautiful, beautiful woman from a very rich family. And my father, that just upset him, you know.
So he felt sort of insecure a little bit.
But you know what happened? So my mother didn't mean it badly, but a chauffeur would take him to the bank every morning, and he said, I don't want to do that because they're going to see me in a Rolls Royce. So he
would... so funny, because remember, I would really be upset when you made me go to school in a limo.
Yeah, I know. So the thing is, he insisted that the car would stop 2 blocks from the bank.
That's exactly what I did, remember?
And he walked.
But do you remember I would make the... Well, maybe you don't know, but I used to make the limo driver stop two blocks from my school so I could walk to school because everyone else took the bus and you wouldn't let me take the bus because that was a dangerous time.
There was a lot of
people trying to, like, kidnap me and stuff.
I know.
But anyway, it's just so funny that I had the exact same experience.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So it's probably kind of like a DNA memory or something.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, that was a really fun talk, Mom. Thank you so much. I wish more interviews were like that.
Sean Lennon there speaking with his mother, Yoko Ono, as part of StoryCorps' National Day of Listening in 2010. If you'd like to share that conversation, you can find a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
This is not looking good. President Obama got pretty emotional, pretty mad earlier tonight. He could not work out a deal. The Republicans walked out. He couldn't work it out. In less than 2 weeks, the U.S. government defaults, and the Federal Reserve announced it is now working on a plan to determine who gets paid first. You know something? I think we all agree. I don't care who gets paid first, just so Congress gets paid last, okay?
The monologue, it's a staple of late-night TV talk shows, and whether it's Johnny Carson, Jay Leno, or Jimmy Fallon delivering it, one thing is for certain. Behind every great monologue is a writer, or a team of writers, tirelessly churning out joke after joke. People like John Max, who reflects on the craft and power of the late-night joke in his new book, Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. John Max spent 22 years writing for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He's also written for the Emmys, the Oscars, the Tonys, as well as some notable politicians, including former President Bill Clinton, Vice President Joe Biden, and President Barack Obama. Jay Max, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, it's great to be here, Virginia. Thank you.
Now, Jay Leno left The Tonight Show in February of 2014. Are you sad that you're missing the run-up to these primaries?
I wake up every morning. I look at what people were saying. I look at Hillary carrying her own bags. I look at what Mike Huckabee has said, outrageous, and I start to cry. I'm very lucky because I still, you know, although I'm not doing a daily show, or nightly show rather, I still get to write for a number of people and still get to exercise my chops a little bit. But I'll be honest, I miss it. It's going to be a great political season.
Yeah. How's this batch of candidates stacking up for comedy writers?
I think fantastic. First of all, you've got, you know, Hillary. She's a known factor. You don't have to explain as if you were doing a joke about Martin O'Malley. If I'm doing a joke about Martin O'Malley, I would say, you know Martin O'Malley. Of course, no one in the audience does. You know, he was the former governor of Maryland who's now running for president. Dead silence. If you just start out a joke by saying Hillary, first name, like Sharon Madonna, said, then you're golden. You know that. So that's great. And on the Republican side, I mean, it's really like a clown car. I mean, you know, it's you know, you open the one door and 24 people pile out. And meanwhile, Jeb Bush is staying in the car saying, I really don't want to be seen with these people. So I think it's going to be great. I think with that many candidates and that many people not ready for prime time, it's ripe for comedy.
Well, you're giving us a little glimpse into the craft. I'd love to go behind the scenes of the monologue writing process. You know, we see the host delivering the monologue for maybe 5 minutes. What went into crafting those 5 minutes of material? How many jokes written and discarded?
In my case, many, many discarded. Every day I would start out, I'd write down nine topics, I call it. I arbitrarily picked a number, nine topics of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So today it might be the NBA playoffs. It might be the opening of Paul Blart's movie. It might be Hillary in her Scooby van. It might be something Jeb Bush had said. Then I start writing jokes, connecting those things, with daily things. It's hot, it's cold, the economy's bad, it's good. And by the end of the day, I'd written about 100 jokes. Jay, over the course of a day, would probably read from all the writers, I'm guessing, around 1,000 jokes.
Wow.
That becomes 100 that he's considering, and that would become, in his case, 25 to 30 that would make the monologue. And then the process starts all over. We used to call it feeding the monster because then, you know, it's done. It's great. The show might be great. It might not be so great that night, but you have to start again the next day.
And you say we, how many writers were on your show?
There was anywhere from 14 to 18 writers at different times. Some of them just did monologues. Some did just bits. I did both, as did a few of the others. But my primary responsibility and the heart of the show for Jay and for many people watch was the monologue.
Mm-hmm. And you were with him for 22 years. So you actually did the math and calculated writing for 4,610 shows. You mentioned 100 plus monologue jokes per show. What did you come up with?
When you add in all the, you know, the 100 jokes a day and you add in what I did on the weekends, and I think it came to somewhere around I wrote 500,000 jokes. Now, because I'm a kind of a statistics, numbers, baseball freak, that sort of guy,
yeah,
I had 18,000 on the air, which means that 482,000 jokes are in a landfill somewhere, you know, or buried in the ocean off of L.A. If I'd write 100, Virginia, and four got on, it was a great night, which means I was rejected 96% of the time.
Well, I guess you got used to rejection, but isn't that a little depressing? I mean, are there any of these precious jokes that you remember? No, that one can't go.
You know, what I found more is something like this. There'd be a great joke I knew had written, and I was so confident it would kill, and Jay would do it, and it would get crickets.
Mm.
Nothing. And then to be like the throwaway joke, which I had done a page, I said, yeah, I better fill out the bottom of the page so it doesn't look I'm like, you know, doing a halfway job here. And I just type something in, and he would do it, and it would kill. And I'd say, I know nothing about this business. I know nothing about this at all. It's one of the reasons I never try to dissect what makes a joke work and what doesn't.
Okay, I was just about to ask you that. So,
you know, I mean, there's a couple things. It's, you know, part of it is obviously the wording has to be exactly right. The delivery has to be good. You can't try to tell people something they're not going to believe. I mean, you can't start out by talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger as being the husband of the year. I mean, you're just not going to believe that. And, you know, and you also have to, you know, the audience, it has to be a good audience. I mean, sometimes the audience is ready to laugh, and sometimes for whatever reason, they're just sitting there a little disconnected. And you could see Jay would turn to Kevin Eubanks and go, it's tough out here tonight, Kev. I'm working it. Which was a kind of way of saying, come on, audience, what's going on here? These are good jokes.
Well, when I hear the term comedy writer, I imagine someone like that, you know, working for their jokes, someone who got their start in the basement of a comedy club or an improv troupe. But you started in politics. Now, how did you wind up going from being a really successful political consultant to comedy writing?
I always started by saying that all the guys I grew up with and were just as funny as me, the difference was I would type things down. They would just say them and I would try to sell them.
Huh.
But I always had two things. I always wanted to be a comedy writer. In fact, when I was 15, I sent jokes into Johnny Carson, which came back rejected in an envelope that said, will not open. And I ended up doing political campaigns for many years. And Paul Simon, when he was senator from Illinois, was doing the gridiron speech, which is a speech where you need to be funny. They always have a Democrat and a Republican in front of the Washington mm-hmm. Press. And Paul said to me, John, you're funny. You make me laugh, you know. So I wrote some jokes, and he delivered them. And then Frank Mankiewicz, who had put the speech together for him, called me up after, said, you know, your joke's really good. You ought to do this for a living, which I actually thought was a way of him telling me that I was a really bad political consultant. Time to switch careers. And I ended up doing, you know, ended up seeing that Jay was buying from freelancers, and I sent some jokes in, and he started using them and giving me $50. And when I'd fly from city to city doing my political campaigns, I would write on the plane in longhand. I would go to the hotel. I'd give the desk clerk $10 to be able to use that 40-foot-long computer you had back then.
Oh, yeah.
I typed them out. I then faxed them. You know, no email, no anything like that back then. Al Gore had not yet invented the internet. And, you know, I would send them in, and Jay would use them, and then in 1992, he was taking over the show, and he gave me a call and said, yeah, I really like your work ethic. You know, you want to come write comedy? So I told my partners, look, this is a 13-week contract. I will be back in 13 weeks. Keep the partnership open. And I'm guessing by now they've shut down my office and give it to somebody else. I'm guessing. I haven't heard from them since 1995. They're a little angry at that point.
I'm speaking with John Max. He's author of the new book, Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. He's a comedy writer. He spent 22 years crafting jokes for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He's also written for Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Steve Martin, and Chris Rock. Well, are certain types of politicians better targets than others?
Well, for me, in terms of targets, first of all, we start with the idea that it's in our American psyche to always say the emperor has no clothes. We always like to make fun up. You know, we overthrew King George and it hasn't stopped, you know, since then. And what you're always looking for when you're doing something about a politician is hypocrisy. I mean, to me, that's the funniest thing about any politician. It is the right winger out there preaching against gay marriage, and it turns out that, well, he might have had a couple male escorts in his life. That's the sort of thing where people get that and expose it. I always contend that that's one of the reasons that Bill Clinton survived his scandals that he had when he was president, because he was never a hypocrite. I mean, you could make fun of it, and obviously he was pretty good joke-wise, but he never preached. You know, he never had a double standard. And so when I'm looking at a politician, I'm either looking for two things: somebody who's a hypocrite, or somebody who just says something that is so out of touch.
You then mentioned Paul Simon. You are a Democrat. You worked on the Kerry campaigns, Obama campaigns. Are you a fair and balanced joke writer, John Max?
I'm actually probably a little unfair and unbalanced towards Democrats. I probably went a little bit overboard. I always separate out, Virginia, that, you know, when I was doing a political consultant, I was a Democrat first. When I'm a comedy writer, the joke's the joke, and that's all that mattered. I mean, I probably wrote more jokes about Democrats simply because I probably went a little overboard that way. And also, a Democrat was president for 13 or 14 of the years that I was on The Tonight Show. So, you know, those are the people generating more news. If I were writing in this election cycle, there would be more jokes about Republicans right now because simply there's 273 people running for president. You know, as that gets weeded down, if it's Hillary versus Jeb Bush or whoever it may be, at that point, then, you know, you're looking for who has the best comedic value. And in that case, I'm going to guess in advance it's going to be Hillary.
Well, actually, since you're a numbers guy, the Center for Public Media and Public Affairs bears you out. That found out of 160,000 of Leno's jokes, 10,885 about Democrats compared to 9,465 about Republicans.
I love when statistics bear me out. It makes me feel good for the day. Fantastic.
Well, you described the monologue as a kind of thermometer that can gauge public opinion, but can it also be a thermostat? Can it sort of turn public opinion on a candidate or an issue?
It really can, and I'll separate out a little bit. Both the late night show itself and the jokes. The late night show itself, as you know, candidates do, you know, come on and change things. To me, the biggest example is probably in 1992. Bill Clinton was in third place in the race. He was behind George H.W. Bush and Ross Perot, and he was a little desperate, and things weren't looking good, and he went on Arsenio. And he came on Arsenio, and he played the saxophone, and he had shades on, and everybody who watched that, and it wasn't jokes about Bill Clinton, it was just watching him, anyone who watched that of his generation said, this is not my father's presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. This is mine. To me, that was the defining moment in the race. It had people look at Bill Clinton a different way, and he ended up being president. In addition, the monologue itself can do it. If you're in the setup of the joke, things are going okay. If you're the punchline, if your name is mentioned as the joke, and people start to laugh in the audience, you better get some new political advisors. Things aren't going too well.
Over the years, have you found anything that Americans just won't laugh at, you know, that are just off limits for topics?
You know, again, it depends on different shows, I think. I think if you're watching something on HBO or cable, you know, you as an audience are probably going to be more accepting and attuned to laughing at different things. But, you know, we always had, you know, a variety of, you know, unspoken rules or just rules we knew. You know, Jay always said it was like the mafia. You always leave the family out. So, you know, Bill and Hillary are fair game. You know, there was no jokes about First Order Chelsea Clinton. And, you know, I know a couple other late night hosts did jokes about her and they got slammed for it and the audience didn't like it. In a time of crisis, you know, whether it's after September 11th or it's during a, you know, a Hurricane Katrina situation, what they want to hear is you do light topics. So in days after that, you're doing what I call a man in Belgium jokes.
Mm-hmm. So you know, what did, do you if, remember what you did after September 11th?
Well, I remember when we first came back, you know, Dave came back first, Letterman. He did the first show, and I think he was brilliant. And then Jay came on the next night. And our opening monologue was very much just about, you know, why are we here? Why are we still doing this? You know, and you know, Jay put it in perspective really well, which is, you know, look, there's people out there who are really risking their lives right now, and there's firefighters and first responders and police officers and soldiers. You know, so, you know, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do, was what he said, which is trying to make you laugh a little and maybe take your mind off of the news of the day. So everything at first was just really light. I mean, jokes about the Cleveland Browns, you know, being a bad football team, and, you know, about some movie star who had done something outrageous. Not that anyone in L.A. would ever do anything like that. But, you know, as time went on, the jokes moved, and you could start making fun of Osama bin Laden. You could mention his name, and you could start, you know, doing things. You know, there's a war in Iraq, and, you know, Saddam Hussein's in a spider hole. That's, the word spider hole is funny to me. And people laughed at that. And then we get into that whole thing of, you know, you diminish your enemy by making fun of them, whether it's Chaplin or Jack Benny in years gone past or our late night comics now.
Do you recall your last joke that you wrote that Jay Leno did?
Yeah, I do. You know, it was the last monologue. It was our last show. And being as shallow and neurotic as anyone in show business, I was praying I'd have one on. I did not want to get shut out that last night. And, you know, we're about halfway through the monologue, and I'm starting to get I'm panicking in the, you know, watching. I'm going, come on, please, just one. For the love of God, just one. And the joke was, he said, you know, a lot of people want to know whether Dave Letterman and I, you know, get along.
I don't know whether Letterman and I actually dislike each other. It's not true. We like each other. We've had a long relationship. We both realize nobody wants to turn on late night TV and see millionaires fighting. That's what Republican primaries are for, okay? That's why you have Republican primaries.
And the minute he said it, I was just so relieved that I had won on the last show.
I'm glad you mentioned that rivalry, because there are rumors that Jay Leno has been invited to appear on one of Dave Letterman's last shows. How would you prep him if he were going to do that?
The answer is, and this is not the answer you want, I wouldn't. There's nobody better in the world than Jay at knowing exactly who he is and what he wants to say and do anything. And unlike a presidential candidate who I would spend weeks prepping, I would just tune in and watch. The one thing to know is, and I have no idea whether Jay's going to go on or not go on. That's his call, and or whether he's been invited. But I do know this. If you look back at all the times that Jay was on Dave in years, you know, past, you know, before, you know, they each got their show, and he would do What's My Beef, and, you know, he would do his rants. The two of them played off each other so well. And you could see an inkling of that if you remember the Super Bowl commercial they did a few years
ago. Right, right.
And you could just see that there's, you know, they have a relationship and they have a respect. So I will be watching to see. And I promise you, the minute I find out, you will be the second person to know.
John Max, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
John Max, he's a comedy writer. He spent 22 years writing jokes for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and is author of the new book Monologue, What Makes America Laugh Before Bed. You can find a lot more, including all of the people that he wrote jokes for. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The fabled American dream travels along a well-worn path. All begin with ambitious and enterprising individuals who give it their all at a good college, then launch into the job market until they distinguish themselves in their field. Unless, of course, they choose the glittery, though frequently thankless, position of personal assistant to a class of celebrities, artists, hedge fund managers, or the other 1% of the 1%ers. Turns out there is an entire pool, code of behavior, and economy among those who dream of rubbing elbows with professionals and celebrities, although they often land in a nightmare of a dead-end job. Francesca Mari is an associate editor at Texas Monthly in Austin and contributor to Dissent magazine, where we found her article, The Assistant Economy. Francesca, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So the personal assistant is not the kind of job you typically see in wanted ads, and I'm wondering how you discovered this hidden market for assistants.
Yeah, so I was an English major in college, and when senior year rolled around and the prospect of having to support myself became a reality, I started looking at what my friends were doing, and tons of them were becoming personal assistants. So they were becoming personal assistants to writers, to politicians, to directors, to Daphne Merkin, to Karl Rove, to Darren Aronofsky, the director of The Wrestler and Black Swan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of how I heard about it.
And we should mention that you were an undergrad at Harvard, so you were at an elite university. It turns out a lot of people recruit personal assistants from the Ivy League schools. What are they looking for?
You know, I think the thing that appeals to personal assistants or to people who apply to become personal assistants is the same thing that appeals to the people seeking them, and that's status. So, you know, when you're an undergrad and you want to become a writer or an artist, there's no real entry-level job for that sort of thing. Learning from a giant seems very appealing and it seems very glamorous. So to become an assistant to Darren Aronofsky is amazing. It's a dream job. You know, if I told my dad that I was his assistant, he'd be so proud. Similarly, I think that, you know, these successful artists and writers and politicians want someone who's impressive and smart and sharp and ambitious working for them. And it's a matter of status to say that they have, you know, a great Yale grad who worships them.
Yes.
So it's a two-way street.
That's kind of the key, isn't it? That worships them and looks up to them. Distinguish, if you would, personal assistant from what we think of as an administrative assistant or a secretary kind of thing. What kind of things might a personal assistant be expected to do?
Secretary sort of denotes a dead-end typing and filing job for women. You know, it sounds like something out of the 60s. Whereas a personal assistant or administrative assistant denotes upward mobility and seems like a gender-neutral position. And so personal assistants, you know, a friend of mine became a personal assistant to Daphne Merkin, who is a very good writer and has written a lot about her struggles with mental illness. And as her assistant, you know, my friend was tasked with everything from helping edit her manuscripts to returning dead houseplants, or, you know, if she had gone on a shopping binge during one of her more manic episodes and bought, you know, 10 sweaters from Barney's, her assistant would be charged with returning many of them. It's kind of like being Nabokov's wife or Tolstoy's wife. Like, you're kind of a life support coach.
I would imagine their wives didn't have to sign non-disclosure agreements, however, you know. Discretion, yeah. I would imagine, is a key factor for somebody to be a personal assistant.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my piece, I talked a little bit about a hedge fund billionaire who solicits applicants from Harvard and sends emails to SUMA students and Phi Beta Kappa students, inviting them to apply, and is very, very cryptic about what the position is that they're applying to. But if you make it to the application round, you end up signing a very serious non-disclosure agreement. And if you get hired, you're not really allowed to say where you work, which is insane.
Hmm. And yet some people do talk about their experience. One who wrote about it, Sigrid Nunez, who was a personal assistant to Susan Sontag. Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah, so Sigrid Nunez is a great writer in her own right. And at the time, Susan Sontag was looking for someone to help her with her correspondence because Sontag had just survived a pretty intense bout of cancer and had, you know, stacks and stacks of letters that she needed to respond to. Nunez was recommended to Sontag by Sontag's editors at the New York Review of Books because they lived near one another on the Upper West Side. And Nunez respected Sontag enormously. And so the relationship was, you know, very interesting and intense. And through Sontag, she met an array of fabulous people, including the great poet Joseph Brodsky. But Nunez was deeply impacted by her relationship because the terms on which they met meant that Sontag forever viewed her as a young mentee and didn't really respect her ever as an equal. And so I think Nunez found that relationship to be somewhat obliterating. And so years after the fact has written a memoir about her experience.
There's one stinging moment where she or Sontag calls her to congratulate her for winning the Rome Prize, this absolutely prestigious prize. And what does she say? Something like, yeah, I turned it down a few years ago or something like that.
Yeah. Sontag couldn't kind of bear to see someone younger than her succeed.
Well, the title of your article is The Assistant Economy, and I'm wondering about the economy. Do people actually get paid their worth? I would imagine if you divided all the hours up for an all-access assistant, it might not come up to much.
No, I think it's a really terribly paid position. If you look at the hedge fund billionaire's personal assistant position, that is extremely well compensated because discretion is so important and because none of the people that he's hiring presumably want to work in that particular field or become a hedge fund billionaire themselves. Instead, he's attracting very brilliant artists and musicians and writers who are a little bit lost and looking for something to do while they kind of figure out their next step. Whereas, you know, a position at the New York Review of Books is notoriously poorly paid because those kids want to become editors. They want to become writers. And that's a great stepping stone for them. And many of them go on to great careers. They move from the New York Review of Books to the New Yorker to Harper's, et cetera.
I'm speaking with Francesca Mari. She recently wrote an article for Dissent magazine about the hidden army of personal assistants who are employed by actors and writers and artists and hedge fund managers and how these jobs differ from more conventional ways of starting a career. Well, Francesca, films like The Devil Wears Prada, we get the impression that being an assistant is sort of like a long hazing process after which someone who sticks with it does earn their success. Does it ever have the opposite effect, you know, maybe driving people away from a possible career?
Yeah, I think personal assistant boss relationships are like any relationship. And there are good ones and there are bad ones. And I'm thinking of John Irving's personal assistant, who is a wonderful writer and a teacher now, and who loved the Irvings. They were very supportive of her. Most of her tasks involved, you know, typing up his manuscript pages. So every day he would write by hand 25 or so pages and leave them on her seat, and she would type them up. And John Irving was dyslexic. And so a lot of her job would be correcting spelling and so on, and then handing him the pages. And as soon as he got those pages, he would read over them and begin editing. And she watched the process through which his stories were created and saw just, you know, the dogged hours that he put into it. She herself wanted to be a writer, and the Irvings were super supportive. They gave her time off to attend the Breadloaf Writers Conference. But she was also kind of exposed to such a great writer that she was intimidated. And ultimately, she decided that she didn't have what it took to be, you know, the level of writer that she wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And so she became a teacher.
Okay, so that's a good story. How about anyone tell you absolutely not? I mean, they just ran screaming from these positions?
I'm sure there are a number of assistants to Scott Rudin, since he's gone through 250 of them, that just ran the other direction and never looked back.
250?
Yeah. He only fizzes up to some 100 or so because he doesn't count those who don't survive his two-week trial period.
So what might be the future job prospects for a personal assistant? You know, an ideal next step?
So I think the professions that have personal assistants, there's no clear career path, and that's why ambitious kids take on these roles that are somewhat secretarial. You know, a personal assistant never advances to become the person that they assist. There's no clear promotion. So I think what people hope for is to make a connection with someone during this position or to develop a mentorship with their boss. And in that regard, the status of your employer determines your success more than the skill level required of your position. And there have been IMDb longitudinal studies that show that. You know, so Noah Baumbach's assistant left when the film that he was working on wrapped, Margot at the Wedding, and he became an assistant to a professor of his at SVA, who was a film critic. And then after that, he made his own movie. And he passed that movie off to Noah Baumbach asking for, you know, feedback. I think the hope is that Baumbach would see the movie, love it, and it would go somewhere. He would, you know, put in a word or put him in touch with something. In this particular instance, Noah Baumbach never responded.
Hmm. It reminds me of the, you know, the Lana Turner sitting there at Schwab's drugstore sipping a milkshake, you know, getting discovered. This whole idea that if you are in the proximity of someone famous, you will be discovered for the talents and special gifts that you have. What do you think? Is this the is this a new American dream?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think that's what's kind of peculiar about the personal assistant position is that those who make the most of it are those who are the most socially apt. It's not the hardest workers or the most creative. It's the people who have sort of the social skills, the manners, the kind of trappings of class or these cultural shared cultural references who are really able to parlay the position and the proximity to someone great into something that works out for them.
After spending some time writing about this, would you ever recommend to somebody to take a job as a personal assistant?
Yeah, actually, if the person you're assisting is great or a kind person, then I think it can be a really worthwhile experience and mentorship. But it's kind of like asking, you know, could you recommend X date Y? You know, you have to know what Y is like.
Francesca Mari, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Francesca Mari, she's associate editor at Texas Monthly based in Austin. She's also a contributor to Dissent magazine. And you'll find her article from Dissent, The Assistant Economy, at wordofmouthradio.org. Personal assistants don't just fetch coffee or take messages. For many, the job requires intimate emotional and physical support to their clients. That is also the mission of a very specialized kind of assistant worth acknowledging this Mother's Day weekend, the doula. Also called a birth companion, the doula is a non-medical assistant who offers laboring mothers support through massage, vocal encouragement, and more. Producer Nina Jacoby was there when doula in training, Megan Sloat, witnessed her very first birth.
Actually, I moved to Portland in August and I didn't even know what a doula was. I'm Megan Sloat. I'm 25 years old. My interest started in women and children's health. And then when I found out what a doula was, I was like, whoa, that's great. I would love to know more about that. I would love to pursue that.
The midwife is there for the baby, and the doula is really there for support for the mom.
I'm Jessica Cross, and my family lives in Gorham, Maine, and I am 1 week away from my due date to have my second child. Megan is going to be my doula.
Doulas aren't trained at all clinically. Our role is emotional support. So to have a constant presence who is trained and knows what's going on and can comfort you and say this is normal, at this point I'm still training. I've never seen a birth. I think I want to be a midwife. I'm thinking about it more and more, and I'm looking forward to an actual birth experience so that I can actually have more evidence of my handling of all that goes down in birth. No drugs, no episiotomy.
I would love to be able to use the hot tub, you know, and to do a water birth.
And that's kind of the plan.
Jessica and Justin Cross, I'm their doula, and Justin wanted me to call you guys and tell you that we're all at the Ballard House and the baby is coming. It's about...
I'll get the tub going.
Now we're at the Ballard House, and Jess is in the second birth suite, and Justin's in there with her, and she's definitely having contractions.
Ow, ow, ow! Ow!
You want pressure on your back?
Jess is in the tub. Justin is on the left of her.
Are these for stopping bleeding?
The Ballard House is like a house. It's called a birth center for community wellness. It doesn't feel like a hospital. It doesn't smell like a hospital. It's not a hospital. No, it hurts. It hurts.
You can do it, Jess.
It totally has this philosophy of natural birth, no medical interventions, unless absolutely necessary.
Oh, it's getting worse.
Okay. That's it.
What I've learned about medical interventions is just that one perpetuates the other.
Oh, my God.
It's just not how it's meant to be, and it's not how it's done in other cultures, and it's just this sort of overcomplicated process that we've created here because we can, but if you don't need them, I don't think you should use them. The baby's heart rate's a little high, like 160 instead of 140, so fluids and cold towels to bring Jess's temper down. I had a bucket of ice water, and I was wringing rags and putting them on her back and her neck and her face.
Oh.
Push down a little bit with it, see how it feels.
Ow!
I was holding her hand. I mean, that's the closest I came to really understanding what she was feeling by the intensity with which she squeezed.
Oh my God, it hurts.
Don't run away from it now. Push into it.
The contractions started being so close together really quickly.
Okay, ready?
Focus, Jess.
Okay.
I don't know. There was all this shuffle of things. Like, I don't even know what there were. Things to clip the cord, towels, suction.
There you go.
Okay.
Oh, Jess, there she's right there.
I was just very present. I was aware of what was happening. I was like, oh my gosh, this woman is giving birth. And like, each contraction, I was thinking, I can't imagine what that feels like. But I
harder, harder,
I know
harder.
That it's working.
No!
It's okay. I need a bulb syringe. Okay.
It was so fast.
Oh my God. Hi, darling. You're okay. I love you.
I thought I might cry.
Hi, darling.
But it didn't at all.
Hi, I'm so
It just seemed very normal, somehow, in that moment. Right here.
Sadie, look. A little bit of light.
Sadie came in. Sadie was super excited.
That's her.
That's her. She's here.
You're definitely a big sister now, darling.
Yeah.
Wow.
You're a big sister.
Mama.
Yeah, darling.
What is Kate doing?
She is trying to figure out this world.
Oh, it's okay. Oh, you did great.
Oh my God.
It went really fast.
It's God.
It's 12:30.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh. That was good, huh?
That was awesome.
You did a really good job. You were very helpful.
Was I? I'm thinking about going on to do more than just be a doula. So,
but yeah. I think I want to do it.
I don't know. It was amazing. This was my first ever.
I was thinking today, after this is all over, there's going to be another little human who's been brought into the world. And tonight, actually, the baby comes into the world and breathes and cries and walks and talks and grows up and lives a life and was born tonight. And that's what happened to all of us. Like, I always forget that I was born too, you know? And now here I am living.
And our thanks to producer Nina Jacoby for that piece. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Since it is Mother's Day weekend, I'm going to shout out to my mother, Patricia Prescott, who had 11 children, of which I am the ninth, without the help of a doula. I love you, Mom. Happy Mother's Day, and happy Mother's Day to all of you out there. We do know that this can be a tough day for anyone who is missing their mother or whose relationship with their mother is or was, well, complicated. Maybe you can find another mother to thank this weekend for doing some of the most important work in the world, raising children. However you choose to acknowledge or celebrate, have a great weekend. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.